Okay, just want to get started and welcome everybody to this panel, China and Africa, the Belt and Road Initiative and the Future of Development Cooperation. We've got a kind of a grandiose topic to kind of talk about, but hopefully we'll touch on some of the key aspects of China's foreign aid and investment policy in Africa. So with me tonight, I have Dr. Huan Zhao. She's a reader in international management at the School of Finance and Management at SOAS, just down the road. Her research focuses on international entrepreneurship and internationalization of emergency economy firms, sustainable entrepreneurship and economic development, and international business under climate change. She's led and participated in research projects funded by the British Academy, EPSRC, Newton Fund, Royal Academy of Engineering, and Foreign and Commonwealth Office. We also have Sam Brazis with us. He's an associate professor in the School of Politics and International Relations at the University College Dublin, and editor of the Journal of International Development. He's currently serving as an economic advisor to the Federal States of Micronesia. His work focuses on the nexus between international political economy and development, with a focus on China's presence in the developing world. So as you'll notice, as advertised, Mr. Mhlana from the South African High Commission was meant to join us, but kind of last minute over the weekend, he was called to be in Scotland this week, so he sends his apologies, and we'll definitely miss his presence. But as such, we as a panel agreed to kind of broaden the discussion beyond just Africa, given the expertise of the panel and Mr. Mhlana's absence. Myself, I'm an associate professor in the political science department here at UCL. My area of research is African political economy, and I'm a political scientist by trade. Great, so with that, what we'll do is we'll kind of hear from Sam first, and then Huan will give us, they'll kind of give us their insights, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion and then open up to questions. So please do have your questions ready. We want this to be as interactive as possible. And again, thanks for coming and attending. So Sam, I'll turn it over to you.
Great, thanks Adam. So thanks for inviting me, and Juan, thanks for being here as well. It's great to meet you. And thanks to all of you for coming. So Adam was very kind. He sent us just a few preparatory questions that I'll try to touch on a little bit. And I'll caveat my remarks that I have neither the expertise on the PRC that Juan has, nor on Africa that Adam has. But you know, I look at development issues from a broader and more general perspective, and sort of the role of China in that bigger picture. So that's what I'll try to touch my remarks on, and leave the nitty gritty of expertise in those areas, to the esteemed panelists here. So you know, the first question that Adam sent us to think about was, what are the pros and cons of China's involvement in Africa? And I think asking about the pros and cons, at least in my view, really gets to the heart of what we think about when we think about PRC engagement in Africa. And that's really that, you know, China's involvement there is nuanced. And to talk about it in a monolithic way, or to talk about it, of course, Africa is an entire continent, right? There's a lot of different dynamics and aspects. And I think a lot of the recent debate around that question has try to frame, you know, is the PRC a villain in the African continent? Is it there to extract resources? Is it there to impose a form of neocolonialism? The alternative countervailing narrative might be, you know, is it a hero? Is it providing sort of, you know, the development model and levels of financial resource that the continent needs to catch up in development? And, you know, there was a great recent book, which many of you may know, by Axel Dreyer and Mike Tierney and colleagues, looking at Banking in Beijing, it's called. And they come to this conclusion that China's neither hero nor villain. And I think maybe, at least in my view, a different way of looking at that might be that the PRC is both hero and villain. And that's because, again, you know, there is no monolith of what the PRC is doing there. We can talk about Chinese engagement that looks much more like what we think about as official development assistance, as concessional financing. That's assistance that's been there for decades, right? That's been doing a lot of different things. As Juan will talk about, there's also a presence of different types of firm actors, and hopefully you'll help me understand to what extent those are state-related or not, but sometimes they may have stronger or weaker ties to the state. But then I think it's also important to remember that, you know, as much as we like to think about, you know, sort of centralized CCP control of the PRC state, there's actually a lot of sub-state actors in the PRC that have been actively engaged in China sort of in their own right, especially at the provincial level. If we look at PRC involvement in the continent going back 50 or 60 years, a lot of sort of the initial exchanges were province-level exchanges. And of course, those actors are going to have their own interests, they're going to have their own methods, they're going to have their own approaches. And so, you know, I think what we could say is that some of the things that the PRC is doing from a con standpoint, you know, could be happening, right? You know, there's probably some truth to those narratives in some areas. But the second major point I want to make on this, right, is that, you know, there also seems to be this sort of myth of Chinese exceptionalism in Africa, that somehow, you know, there's a slew of papers, and I think I'm probably guilty of a few of these, right, that, you know, end China, da-da-da-da, with Chinese characteristics, right? But I think what a lot of research has found is that much of the PRC's engagement in the continent looks very similar to that of other DAC donors, of other major powerful actors that have been involved there, who are also either neither hero nor villain or both hero and villain. The one exception or caveat I would say to that, right, is certainly historically, and this may be changing, there is much less of a focus on transparency, right, with what the PRC is doing. So it's been harder, and to figure out what the PRC has been doing in Africa, it's taken great work, efforts of folks like Deborah Boudingham or the A-Data people or in Boston, you know, to try to track down and figure that out. And I'm not clear enough on this if that's an intentional choice on the PRC or if just, again, because the involvement is so complex that there hasn't necessarily historically been the capacity to make that information transparent. The second question that Adam prompted us, and I won't say too much on this because I think this is Juan's area, you know, does China's aid and FDI pressure Western donors to adjust and improve their delivery? And I think this may be where this transparency issue causes trouble, right? Because when there's a lack of transparency, all sorts of different actors, be they state actors, be they international organizations, you know, are probably going to default to their priors, you know, and sort of expect either the best or the worst, right? And so that then potentially leads to stressing of a lot of factors that have traditionally plagued international aid effectiveness, things like harmonization or donor coordination, things like volatility and concessional flows. You know, if you don't know what the other major actors are doing, then it's hard to coordinate and sort of solve those problems. And there's also sort of the second brief thing I would say on this, right? You know, a lot of the scholarship in this area has, you know, noted the PRC's broad outward principle of non-interference and state sovereignty, right? And, you know, sort of what to make of this. And I think the lazy narrative of this, of which I'm also, again, probably guilty, right, is that, you know, China's assistance, the PRC's assistance, comes with no strings attached. And so as a result, there's going to be kind of this, you know, automatic preference to engage with the PRC, right, rather than DAC donors or other actors, you know, because the PRC just sort of gives you the resource, you can do whatever you want. I don't know if that's necessarily true in all cases, but I think a lot of folks in the DAC policy world have bought into a version of that narrative, and it probably has adjusted how they are engaging, right? There does appear to be evidence out there that, you know, in places where the PRC is and there are also DAC donors or the World Bank, you know, that we see less conditionality, we see less strings, right, coming from those actors. So, you know, there could be a little bit of kind of this aid competition or assistance competition. And then the final question, these are all so nice and small and focused, I think, yeah. Adam. You know, what are the long-term impacts of Chinese involvement and what does the future of China-African cooperation look like? The thing I would say first is some of it already is long-term, right? So, you know, the PRC has been in a lot of places on the continent for a long time, as long as many of the DAC donors. Secondly, and this touches on the first one, you know, there is a lot of evidence, I think, especially that some types of PRC flows, maybe particularly sort of these concessional finance flows, do seem to be effective when we think about them in terms of aid effectiveness. You know, there's work that suggests that this kind of assistance boosts economic growth. There's, you know, evidence that sort of, you know, Chinese health teams are serving underserved countries or regions, right, where other assistance may not reach. So, you know, I think that there's are some positive things that we can look for. That said, right, you know, I think there's a big overhanging question on as PRC assistance has transitioned from more concessional assistance to non-concessional assistance or private engagement, most notably, and in the context of the BRI, a substantial increase in debt, both sort of official and unofficial, a little bit off the books, or at least sort of hidden in the books, right? You know, what is the impact of that going to be, especially when the bill starts to come due, right? And I think we're already sort of seeing this now. And again, this touches on the second theme, where this is creating a big challenge for a lot of the traditional creditors in Africa, who are finding out that now, you know, there might have been a lot of, you know, non-transparent debt in a country that they're thinking about, you know, extending loan agreements to, and the PRC is the source of that debt. And so what sort of happens with that? And then the final point that I would make, right, and this maybe ventures a little bit outside my expertise, so I will stand to be corrected, is that, you know, I think we have to think about what are the PRC's goals. And like I said, lots of nuanced actor goals, but if we want to think, you know, broadly, what is at least the central government trying to do, I would hazard a guess, which I'm happy to be corrected on, that, you know, we have to remember that the PRC and the CCP are first and foremost interested in their own domestic legitimacy, right? This is the primary goal. So, you know, when we think about the going out policy, when we think about the BRI, right, we think about the PRC, you know, trying to attract friends and shape the international normative environment, right? This isn't necessarily because the PRC has, you know, big ideas or the CCP has big ideas or grand designs for global governance, right? It's because the CCP wants to create a world in which the CCP is a legitimate and safe actor that has lots of other state actors that uphold that legitimacy. So I have a colleague at University College Dublin who does a lot of great work on comparative authoritarianism, Alex Dukalski, and he's a fantastic book which I recommend reading, which is, you know, called Making the World Safe for Dictatorship. Right? And, you know, this is sort of the idea. It isn't necessarily so much about, I mean, of course there are other objectives, but, you know, one of the overarching objectives we might think is, you know, this is about making the world a place where the CCP can exist with domestic legitimacy. So apologies if I ran a little over, Adam, but hopefully those are, I'm not too far off on some of those themes.
Thanks, Adam.
All right. Okay. So thank you, Adam, and thank you, Samuel, to kick off. Honestly, I think it's very interesting for me to be in this position talking about this broad topic about China and Africa relationship, because I think, because it's hosted by the political department, so but I'm pretty much like an outsider, and then to provide more international business and entrepreneurship perspective. So it may not be really within your comfortable zone, but I hope that to give you some kinds of fresh insight. So back to those kinds of three or four big questions that Sammy already touched. I tend to be a little bit cheeky rather than provide direct answer to them. I was thinking about when we're talking about China-Africa relationship, as we said, it's so broad. But to be honest, there's so many differences across this kinds of big topic. So I think there are a couple of key important relation issues related to dynamics. I think it's very important when we talk about business, we talk about dynamics. We're not living in certain kind of static state, everything's moving on, and then sometimes it's quite linear, but most of the time it's not. So I think it's very important to recognize the nature of the dynamics in this kinds of China-Africa context. So the first thing I would like to mention about is the relationship between China and Africa is quite dynamic. If we look back, you know, when the relationship, do correct me because it's about international politics, started from 1950s. So actually it's almost 70 years. And then so it's very interesting to look what started and then moved across over the different leadership of CCP and then see the focus from the relationship with African countries pretty much like we're brothers, right? And now it's more particular certain kinds of commercial and then more economic oriented relationship. So it's very important to recognize these kinds of transformation of the dynamic relationship between the two big regional markets, let's put it this way. The second one I would like to talk about is the dynamics even within the African continent. So we all know how many countries involved, and then definitely I have to admit I'm not African expert, and I really want to go to the continent and then see what goes on there. But what I understand is that normally the UN and also these kinds of World Economic Forum talk about the different categories of African countries. Some they really resource affluent, like oil, because this is one of their largest trading partners with China. But there are also certain kinds of resource poor countries, right? And then they actually, some actually landlocked, some actually coastal. So this is such a vast diversity across the African continent that we're talking about. And then it would be quite naive to think China or CCT's relationship with each one is the same. So there's such a huge heterogeneity across the relationship. And then this also relates to the transparency, is that some kinds of myths or the narratives, especially from media talking about China, tend to ignore those kinds of governance issues, and then they invested more in those less transparent, less democratic countries. But if we do look at a figure, actually South Africa tend to be the most transparent across the region, actually is the largest recipient of the Chinese investment. So this is certain kinds of a counterpoint. To be honest, I agree with what Samuel mentioned, is that maybe China is no different, right? China is no different from the other players who have already existing in Africa, no matter of the historic reason, or maybe they're also the new entrants into the market. So this is the second point I would like to make. Then the third one is about the dynamics regarding the investment. Like Samuel mentioned about, is that I'm particularly interested in understanding different types of player in the market, because under the spotlight, we know that lots of contracts, lots of these kinds of government and driven projects. And so there might be certain kinds of questions I would like to ask you guys, is that who do you think, what kinds of major sectors or industries you think that Chinese involvement in Africa? What kinds of industries?
Manufacturer,
yeah.
Any strategic minerals.
So yeah, so those kinds of resources.
Textiles and manufactured goods. In.
Yeah. Infrastructure. Infrastructure. Yeah. So we actually, the reason why we had this kind of impression, because lots of media, lots of reports, even the narrative from the party actually talk a lot about these kinds of major mega projects, especially infrastructure regarding the port, railway, so on and so forth. Manufacturing, of course, because with those kinds of large-scale contracts going to the different regions in Africa, we have seen that. But to be honest, if we look at data of MOCOM, it's funny because when I try to update the data, I can see that things actually stopped kind of by 2019. So there's not really latest on the MOCOM website. But service industry actually is one of the largest in particular countries. So this is something that we're really not looking to, is that such a diversity and dynamics in terms of the sector that Chinese involvement actually are in place. And then we think about who are the major players, right? So the impression, again, is large state-owned enterprises, because the mining and then, you know, the port, or they actually are pushed by the large state-owned enterprises from China, backed by the Chinese investment bank or the other banks. Then, to be honest, there are so many small firms also entering China, entering Africa. And then what they have been doing might be quite different from the large companies do, because of the difference across the ownership, corporate governance, the infrastructure, or certain kinds of a sector they operate. So it's going to be quite naive, again, to think all Chinese firms behave the same way in Africa. So this is the point I would like to make. The last one I would like to think about is about international business scape, the landscape. So it's very interesting. I said I did my degree in international politics, and I tried to run away from it. And then, yeah, this is what I try to communicate with my IB scholars. We found is international political economy now back to the core of international business. And which is such a fancy perspective to look into, because the geopolitics, especially during the past decades, the tension between China and the US, and then all these kinds of conflicts across the different continents, and then the climate change and the big topics, what we call the ground challenges, as also we know the United Nations, the Sustainable Development Goal. So all this actually shaped the way how international business is going to go in the next decade, and that's my personal opinion. So the question here is, like, you know, likely touch what Adam set the homework for me, of course. What we see in future, right? And then I think rather than think about China plays like a villain or hero, maybe we still actually living in those kinds of old mindset, rather than changing our perspective to think about how we can move things forward. Because the world needs kinds of a new thinking strategy, rather than have those kind of Cold War stuff. And then from business perspective, we're more concerned about what really can benefit from the investment, right? So in business field, we're talking about the reason why foreign direct investment is quite favorable. We're not saying that it's perfect. Nothing is perfect here. When China started its open door policy, foreign investment was welcomed by the state government. But if we talk to the local, things actually will have lots of obstacles. So it is the same case, you know, when Chinese investment into Africa or Chinese investment into the UK. But the point I would like to make here is like, what the consequence afterwards? We can have short-term, mid-term, and a long-term perspective, depending on how long we're going to live. If we just look at short-term, then definitely there's going to be lots of tension because people from different planets, and the people talking about different languages, and the people will have their own interests to protect, no matter it's from the economic sense or it's from ideological sense. But if we look at mid-term and long-term, and that's the perfect example of Chinese economic development. We're not saying Chinese development is always kind of smoothy, driving full steam. It did actually have bottleneck. It did need change. So that's why the dynamics is very important depending on what kinds of landscape and timescale we're looking into. So if we're looking into Chinese involvement and how the future operation is going to be, I think personally, I do think infrastructure investment is important because this morning, the breaking news from BBC is saying the high-speed project is going to pause because of the living cost, because of the other thing. But thinking about the case in this country, the reason why the plan was initially welcomed to some because it wanted to boost the economy outside of London. And they're trying to connect to London and then the rest of the region. And why infrastructure is so important, because from business perspective, we need logistics. We need to move those kind of resources, no matter it's metal, zinc, whatsoever. We need to ship them to the place where manufacturing procurement can happen. So if the infrastructure is not in place, don't talk about anything else further. So if we're saying currently lots of projects, China punched money into the infrastructure, okay, they may have some other consideration. We do not know because we're not really those kinds of high-profile policymakers. But we would like to see whether those kind of infrastructure investment do benefit the locals, whether they do bring certain kinds of what we call productive spillovers, right? Create a job in a short time period, and then bring the opportunity to provide value-added products or services to the market. So if we look at Africa currently, we can kind of do some comparative study about what China 20, 30 years ago. Quite a similar demographics profile. But if we look now China, because definitely it has already boosted its economy, the demographic profile has changed so dramatically as well, because we all know the labor cost has increased a lot. But the labor cost in Africa is still cheap. So I think there are lots of things we can go into to look into what China may provide certain kinds of lessons and experience to the economic development for Africa, rather than saying Africa needs to follow the development model, because I don't think one model fits all. The last point I would like to make is that from entrepreneurial perspective, I think when we talk about entrepreneurship in the setting we are now, we always fancy it with innovation. We fancy it with, you know, all these kind of Elon Musk style entrepreneurs. But actually, it's not in the context of Africa or emerging economies. Entrepreneurship, most of the time, come out from necessity. People need to find a job. People need to actually sustain their living for their household. And this is exactly what we have seen in African countries. where lots of what we call social enterprises, which means that they do not really drive food steam for profit. They're actually trying to respond to certain kinds of social value to understand what the local issues, local problems. Then to me, my interest will be see whether those kinds of local need can be sustained in the long term. Last week, I was looking certain kinds of cases about African social enterprises. It's very interesting because when we do research here, we can easily go to the company register, right? You get all these kinds of detail. But, and then you can also go to the website of those kind of companies. Social enterprises in Africa, you couldn't. Their website actually is on Facebook. And then the next question is like, where they have gone. Most of them actually didn't update since 2018 or 2019. So COVID definitely gonna be a trigger or certain kind of hitting point. But I would be really interesting to see whether entrepreneurship can be a driving engine for African companies or African economic growth, like what we have seen in other emerging economies. If we look at newly industrialized economies, look what has been happening in China, and sincerely, I do hope that entrepreneurial activities, those kind of social enterprises, which have received lots of investment and spotlight in latest years, can really boom and can really provide a new chapter for African countries. I'll stop here.
Excellent, thank you. Thank you both. So I've got pages of notes. Let me start with, I've got one question based on, I think Juan said then a couple for Sam, but let me start with where you left off. I think this point about social enterprises and entrepreneurship,
Social enterprises and entrepreneurship is really, really interesting. And I'm going to bring two points together, and if I'm incorrect in doing this, just correct me and answer and respond however you like. But you're talking about that and how they've received some investment. And I wonder, and then you also mentioned the smaller firms from China.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is there any way that, so first question is, do these smaller firms lack the close connection with the state, with the Chinese state, relative to the larger state-owned enterprises or the really big investment firms? Mm-hmm. And is there space for these smaller firms to be able to partner with some of these social enterprise at the local level in Africa developing context to kind of harness what is needed and what is the necessity to also maybe marry that with profit-seeking goals? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. I wish I could have more detailed data, credible sources, but I think one of the major obstacles for research is that we do not really have those kinds of detailed information, especially about small or even micro, these kinds of employment in Africa. So we can just roughly guess about. So I think I do have some figures about how many contract workers are more than 200,000. And then most of those kinds of
These are contract workers
in Africa.
From China.
China. And then if we look at how many these kinds of small and medium Chinese firms, the data actually grew rapidly from 3 million. So those we are talking about firms rather than workers, actually jumped to 43 million by 2018. I'm not quite sure whether the figures really add up. But if we look at the way how these kinds of small, medium-sized firms operate, they pretty much actually followed by the large SOEs. Let's put it this way. So when large state-owned enterprises invest in large contracts or those kind of infrastructure projects, the smallers come in. So they provide service, restaurants, and all this why I ask you guys the question is the where the major sectors that those kind of investment in. So this is quite different from, they try to find their niche, right? They're not going to be really competitive with those kind of large players, but they can actually have those kind of spillover and market to go in. Then you also mentioned the entrepreneurship. The funny thing is like, we have been looking at demographics about the population, the younger population in Africa. And then we could see that the majority, the pyramids of the population is really nice to project what the future labor force could be. So if we're thinking about, okay, I'm not quite sure how many people use a TikTok, but according to TikTok, actually 6 million South Africans use TikTok. And then total population of South Africa currently hasn't reached 60 million, which means 10% people using TikTok. I'm not judging whether it's good or not, but there is a market, right? There is a market for this kind of e-commerce or social media, influence marketing, whatever we call it. So there is a big opportunity for enterprise to think they can be connected outside African markets. I can give an example is that we all know Alibaba, Jackie Ma. So before he had all these kinds of things we're not going to touch, but one of the initiatives that Alibaba actually proposed is they call it global insights, particularly actually try to promote and facilitate the entrepreneurial ideas and activities in Africa, starting from 2018, if I remember correctly. The beauty of it is that what he said, he did see what African nowadays pretty much when he started Alibaba back to his old days. You know, there's a big population, there's a big potential of labor force, but there's a lack of infrastructure in terms of internet, broadband, whatsoever. But then you need to find the opportunity whether this kind of a future projection gonna be the way. And I believe so. I think that Africa definitely is working on it. Looking at fintech, looking at OPay and then Floodwave or whatsoever. So there is a huge market there. And then this can actually help with those kind of loan and then financial debt or whatsoever. And the most important thing, it really builds business opportunities for remote communities, which they do not physically or geographically can be linked to the global market. And with the e-commerce, with the infrastructure especially, we're not talking about road, railway whatsoever, but we're talking about infrastructure in those kinds of digital platform. This could be a boost or gateway for future.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Thank you. Sam, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's fascinating. I think I really like this interdisciplinary perspective of business and then us as the politics guys, right? Because, I mean, I think Jack Ma is like exactly at the heart of what has to be touched with this, you know, as an example. Because, you know, when we think about Chinese FDI in particular, right, when we're thinking about business and entrepreneurship, you know, we know the importance of the governance processes in place, right, for that, of rule of the law, of, you know, some form of accountability, of all these kind of things. And of course, China's economic development model has very much gone hand in hand with its governance model. And so, you know, when you think of someone like Jack Ma, who was incredibly successful economically, you know, said something that really wasn't that critical, and now, I don't know, it was like stashed away in a cabin somewhere. I don't know if anybody's seen it recently, right? It wonders how portable those models and how hand-in-hand those models need to go. And certainly, I think one of the things that we've seen with the PRC's engagement on the African continent, right, and this is what a lot of regimes like about engaging with the PRC, is that they're not overly concerned about those countries' governance models. And so, you know, if PRC commercial engagement undermines the governance models that those countries need to promote their version of a development model, as you appropriately noted, you know, is different by country. I think that's one area, and I think I'm going to stick by, you know, that China is both villain and hero in the same way that I would say that about the United States or the World Bank. You know, I think there are clearly things that all these actors do that have good effects, right, and there are things that have bad effects. So it's not that this is some sort of gray, amoral, sort of neutral world, you know, non-value-laden world that we live in. Everything is value-laden, right? And so, you know, it's thinking about those balances there. So, I think the governance piece is probably the biggest open question, right, that we can think about looking forward on the continent and the PRC's engagement.
I may have slightly different thinking about the governance because, you know, from business perspective, we did not really. We do think institutional framework or these kinds of, you know, regulatory rules of law do apply. But it's very interesting when we look at entrepreneurial activities and then how much effect from those kinds of governance or institutional support or lack of institutional support. So I'm not quite sure, maybe I'm really not correct, is to look at the internet, because most of the time when internet started in China, that's the first bubble, which I remember that back to 2000. That's the first returnee entrepreneurs back to China. But then Jackie Ma, actually, he's later to come into the game, right? And then in addition to what he has done, there are also other players, other entrepreneurs in China. So I'm not quite sure whether he definitely is quite under spotlight, but also I think about the idea to facilitate entrepreneurial activities. The way how the ecosystem that can provide, I'm talking about different stakeholders, talking about government for sure, that the government should have provide a very transparent, supportive, and unfortunately when Chinese internet or e-commerce started, that was not in place. So the government wanted to correct it or try to make sure that we have them under control. So this might be the lesson that can be learned from the other countries, including Africa. But what I'm trying to think about is about the way how freedom can be given to entrepreneurial activity. Sometimes if we compare with the other countries, if the resources heavily controlled by large firms, like what we see South Korea or Japan, these kinds of entrepreneurial activities may not be so free to come out. They do not really have the soil. And then people may be reluctant to actually put their things at a stake or on the table. So this is something we have to think about entrepreneurship from a different perspective. And if we look into the context of Africa, that's what I'm saying is I'm pretty into, yes, the governance is going to be a big issue for the entrepreneurs to grow, right? There are lots of issues when a firm's actually grow, then more things need to be taken into account. But whether we can really cultivate the culture to actually drive those kinds of new ideas, give them the platform, and then provide the support, you know, either human resource support or financial support. If the country itself may not be, like the case, I think there is a very good example is that I think it's their fintech, I forgot the name, but there is a consortium, investors, the VC, actually chipped money into, I think it's OPay. So they actually had the investment from Didi, from the other DMP, and then all these kind of Chinese big players. So I'm thinking about this might be one example. They can be actually invested or receive investment from a different source of investment. But if the ecosystem can be there, which can help the entrepreneurial ideas to grow, it will be great because there are lots of things that need to be addressed, like food security, like water issues, because these are the major concern for the international aid projects that have been going on in Africa over the past years. But we did not really see the problems resolved after such a long time. I don't know why. So Samuel may give some answers. If the top down not working, then how about bottom up? Right? So there's lots of talking about India innovations, not really those kinds of very beautified innovation. They call it frugal innovation. They call it grassroots innovation, which means they literally deal with the grassroots problems, which the policymakers may have no idea because they may live in a bubble. Or international financial institutions, they do not because they still hold quite European-centric or North American-centric view. So sometimes I think Chinese model, like what Samuel mentioned, I did mention about, is the core is to understand how China can protect its domestic stability. And which means that we do not need to apply the best practice to some other regions, but try to think about what we can learn from the others and then let people decide what they can do for the best of it.
Yeah, excellent. So, I mean, a lot of things running through my mind, and I don't want to take up too much time, but it's, let me just leave that, and we can come back to it if people are interested. But another question that I had, and then after this we can go to questions from the audience. is this, so, yeah, so I like the discussion about, like, is it neither or both of a villain or a hero? And I like Juan's contribution that, you know, actually this is old thinking and we don't need to think in these rivalries, right? Although the West definitely thinks of this, right? And the rising tiger of China coming in and taking over its hegemonic influence, right? And so it's hard to not think of that when that is how policymakers and the media is framing this. But what's interesting is that this idea of a rivalry presents this question about coordination, which across, you know, DAC, donors, and other quote-unquote non-traditional donors, which China fits into, right? And so one question that I had is, in this links to the kind of transparency, is the lack of transparency prevents this coordination, right? The DAC donors are like, China needs to agree to following these monitoring procedures and making sure that we're more transparent, that you're following the same kind of good governance or good practice guidelines that we have. And China's like, no, we have our own kind of approach. But is this coordination, is this kind of unified aid approach desirable? Because you mentioned also, Sam, this competition, right? That maybe if the West is unwilling to fund something, but China is, then there's more of a marketplace where developing countries can choose what they need, choose what they want and get what they need, rather than a hegemonic kind of unified aid approach that's like, no, you have to do X, Y, Z or you're not getting the money. Or as, you know, World Bank, et cetera, is we want to fund this and this is all you can get from us. You want infrastructure? We're not doing that. We want to do something else. So I guess this is my long-winded question of, is it healthy to have this alternative choice in the form of China and other types of donors, or should we have this more unified, transparent, best practice approach that the West has adopted?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Because I mean, we all know that, you know, there are huge financing needs across the globe, certainly, you know, in the developing world, certainly on the continent of Africa. You know, to face not just the challenges in achieving the SDGs, but to, you know, face additional, you know, continuing, ongoing, increasing challenges of climate change and adaptation. So, you know, it's hard to say that, you know, more resources is a bad thing, right? And you know, the needs are there. And certainly through at least the initial stages of the BRI promises prior to COVID, you know, it looked like a lot of infrastructure money would, new infrastructure money would be coming through BRI. Now, how much of that is actually going to be realized? It seems to be a shifting landscape. That said, you know, unless, you know, years of OECD practice are wrong, which they could be, right? You know, it certainly seems that, and I think just, you know, practical experience from the field, that it's hard enough for countries in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world, you know, to coordinate and manage assistance programs, right, when they are all playing by the same rules. You know, it's amazing how, you know, how infrequently, you know, the Europeans will talk to the Americans about what they're doing in a country, right? And so, you know, having another major player who you're not even sure what's doing, you know, it seems to increase those capacity challenges. And, you know, that's certainly one of the reasons a lot of folks would say aid hasn't worked in a lot of these ways, right? Because it gets captured, because it gets misutilized, because it's fungible, right? All these sorts of things. So yeah, I don't think that was a very satisfying question, your answer. I mean, yes, the resources are good and needed. But as you mentioned, you know, I mean, you know, only in the past few years, right, has the PRC established sort of an aid agency, right? You know, prior to this, you know, there wasn't even really a recognition that this is development. So this is just, you know, as was mentioned, you know, sort of solidarity and partnership going back. So, you know, I think folks were hopeful with, you know, I mean, again, it's sort of a contradiction. You get the establishment of alternative organizations like the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, right, or the New Development Bank. And, you know, big question, are these parallel institutions? You know, are these supposed to replace? Are they, you know, revisionist institutions? But then, you know, sort of hopeful people say, well, look, they brought on board a lot of people from the World Bank and they're co-financing programs with the World Bank. And so it seems that the door was there, But as, and I don't think this is a one-way street that, you know, the West or the DACT owners, you know, are framing things as strategic rivalry, right? I mean, certainly the PRC is doing this too for some audiences. I mean, I think what's really important when we think about PRC media and messaging, right, is it looks very different for different audiences. It looks very different domestically as it does externally, and even in different regions of the world, right, what the PRC is saying looks very different. And then there's also, I mean, we just can't ignore the PRC's actions, right? You know, even if they're saying, you know, still, you know, like, there are things that they're doing that are pushing up against the bounds of international norms or international law in places like the South China Sea or the East China Sea, right, that, you know, would be at odds with that. So, you know, I think I don't want to be pessimistic, but it seems that that door is closing a little bit, but that some of the institutional structures could be there if there was a way to try to prise the door open a bit again.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And thinking about the domestic legitimacy and thinking about how that drives a lot of what China is doing internationally, how that might play in the role of opening or closing that door, more or less. Great. I think, well, so one thing that I did want to...
Let's turn to the audience. They've been so patient. Yeah.
So is that, like, there is, again, drawing on the Banking on Beijing book, that does find a lot of positive effects of Chinese aid and investment, especially in the African context, where it doesn't find similar positive effects in the Americas and some positive effects, but a bit mixed in Asia. It's also interesting to think about the context in which it's more or less effective, but that's maybe a question for another time. But yes, great. Okay, thank you. So now we can go to audience questions. Good, we have hands.
Thank you all very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I'm a former tax inspector who's worked in for World Bank and UN and EU projects in both West and East Africa. I can certainly sympathize with the point about poor coordination, regardless of any Chinese presence. It is extremely difficult. Two quick questions. One, on debt relief or not. What actually is the current situation in Africa with debt owed to the Chinese? I mean, a year or two back, we heard an awful lot about, though it went rather quiet, about the situation regarding Entebbe Airport in Uganda, which, of course, is a place with a very long history, well known to China, not least to military academies there. But then it went rather quiet about whether China was taking over the airport. So I just wonder, what is the debt situation as you understand it now? And very quickly, a second question. I have watched the film Wolf Warrior 2.
No, sorry.
The film Wolf Warrior 2. Have you watched it? I ask nothing more than that. I would just say, if you haven't, I strongly advise watching it.
Are we taking the questions in groups?
Yeah, since you have to bring the mic back, we'll take three questions and then we can go.
Yeah, does the PRC produce any statistics comparing the total value of Chinese investment overseas split by the main areas such as Europe, America, Southeast Asia, Africa?
Just a simple question. Do you recommend any Africanist British that we can see on YouTube? Example, I follow one, French one is very famous.
Sorry.
Some British Africanist expert British in Africa Africanist. That I would like to see.
Maybe I could take a stab at one if you want to take a stab at two, and you can take a stab at three.
Yeah, I can
that
take
seems,
a stab
that
three.
Seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
I think we've got. So debt. I think this is a really interesting and open question that is going to really shape this post-COVID engagement. Again, you know, not to toot Data's horn too much, but they did some great work recently where they got a hold of a bunch of debt contracts, right, of loan contracts, and this gets to the point of transparency. A lot of what was found wasn't listed as official government debt, and sort of the corporate structure of this lending was really complex. So I don't think that anyone has a real good picture of, I mean, I think they have the best picture, but they sort of only took a subsample, you know, sort of total debt obligations, you know, that ultimately would lead back to the Chinese state. I also think, and this probably puts me in the minority of folks thinking about China and the developing world, that, you know, sort of Deborah Brautingham and the folks at CARI, the Center for Africa Chinese Research Initiative, Africa Research Initiative, you know, have had this big thing that, you know, debt trap diplomacy, this is dead, this isn't the thing. They look at Hambantota Port, they say, oh, that wasn't really debt trap. I think it's too early to say. I mean, it may not be sort of active debt trap, but given the fact that there's not transparency on all this debt, and I don't think that the rubber has really hit the road yet for when the bills come due. I mean, I think we have to remember that, you know, the PRC and the CCP have very long time horizons, right? So, you know, they may be willing to, you know, tolerate structures or modify structures for a long time in ways that don't really force the issue. And I don't think we've really seen examples yet of what happens when the issue gets forced. And so I don't think we can answer that question until we see that. And, you know, I think if there is a broader global downturn, you know, this year and the next few years, which for some reason we seem to be avoiding, right, you know, maybe some of those questions start to get forced and that gets fleshed out a little bit more. Statistics, PRC statistics on investment. That's definitely you.
I'll speak to you like Warrior movie, Duffenthagen. And yes, the MOFCOM does provide statistics, not just between China and Africa, and they also provide other regional statistics with states, United States, and European Union, so on and so forth. Normally, there's monthly briefing and monthly statistics in a very general sense.
How do they compare in terms of total quantum for each region?
So that's the same. So for the MOFCOM statistics, actually, you normally get a general picture of it, and then you need to go to the statistics. Sometimes they do publish about different sectors, and then you can look into the difference across the regions. And also, depending on the statistic information you're looking for, because if we're looking at the trade, the import and export, they are quite straightforward. But if we're looking at investment projects, then things can go really messy, let's put it this way. So there is a website, I think it's the Global Project, oh gosh, I kind of forgot, but they actually provide construction, investment, and One Belt, One Road initiative. So they break down into different ones. So that's apart from the MOFCOM, so it's more about third party. But when I look at information, the majority still actually, you know, concentrated on the infrastructure, matter, all these kinds of very heavily invested, driven by the state-owned enterprises. There are certain kinds for new emergence, like what I mentioned about the telecommunication or logistics, but that more actually tend to be the ports, the railways, so on and so forth. But yes, China does provide the information.
Do you have any idea, I mean, you know, not taking hard figures, because, you know, it's difficult to chop these out, but do you have any sense of what the pecking order is? Is there more in Africa than in Europe, or more in Europe than...
That's a very interesting question, because to be honest, when we think about China has really invested heavily in Africa, but if you look at total volume and amount of Chinese OFDI, believe me or not, it's quite a small proportion. So that's the question, is that if we just focus and have a snapshot about China-Africa, yes, China has building its increasing, you know, attention from the media or from academics, from policymakers. But if we're looking to the Chinese OFDR across the globe, maybe Africa is not as important as we are talking here.
Yeah, so then the... So I'll say one thing about debt in Africa. Not that I have like statistics or, you know, getting this information is hard. But one thing that was interesting is that Kenya, with its it got financing for the rail between
Nairobi and Mombasa, right? And that was this great successful project. It didn't turn a profit in the end, and that caused problems for repayment. And then the Kenyan government went back to China to ask for more money to continue the rail to connect another port, inner city to a port. And China said no, right? Because it was seeing how its debt to GDP ratio or GNI ratio was looking, and it was in the, it went from 45 when the first loan came to 60, and they're like, okay, no, we can't actually give you any more. So there is, so that's just kind of nuanced the idea of kind of debt trap diplomacy not being evidenced, at least in this one anecdote. But again, if you look more, and if you're interested, we highly recommend this Banking on Beijing book to look at kind of the ways in which China is managing this debt and the way governments are also choosing to manage or not the debt.
Yeah, I mean, that's just to follow up on that, I mean, that's a one good point that the folks that have looked into these loan contracts have found is that oftentimes the debt isn't collateralized with, you know, sort of natural resources, which I think oftentimes, you know, is sort of the popular narrative that, oh, you know, you got to put up your oil and then we'll give you the money. But it's tied to income streams from the projects, from rail projects or I think there's also a motorway project that just opened right in Kenya. But the terms of the contracts guarantee the PRC's investment partner the return, whether it's utilized or not. Right, so it becomes effectively a state-backed debt obligation, right, in Kenya, but that won't show up on official debt statistics, right? So, you know, they've promised this level of return on the investment, you know, through these contracts, which are oftentimes hidden from public view. And so, you know, there's a lot of nuance to what we mean, like the same way, what do we mean with PRC aid, what do we mean with PRC debt? Yeah, exactly.
And if we add to that, from the firm perspective, we're thinking about why firms would like to go to invest in Africa. I think that's back to the question that we ask all international business scholars and international firms. Is the reason why we want to go there either because there's a market, right? That's why lots of Western companies go to China, because it's a large population and there's a huge consumption opportunity there. Or there might be the resource, like what we're talking about, there's oil, there's certain kinds of resources, but thinking about, you know, how sustainable. You know, it's going to drain out, and especially the Chinese economy has transformed or has tried to shift from the export-oriented, and they're trying to, you know, ease off those kinds of domestic capacity access. So it's not going to sustain, you know, the next 20 or 30 years and then trying to exploit the resource in Africa. So this is the question we think about. If the Chinese firms go to the market more from the firm's perspective and try to make profit, and then that's back to the debt issues, is that if they fund out all the previous projects gonna end up with a loss, you know, as a rational thinker, they would not go on and on, right? Even though they're state-owned enterprises, they have a dual responsibility, but you know, they also need to actually answer to their shareholders, because if we look at state-owned enterprises, they're also public share in the stock market in Hong Kong or in Shanghai. So they're quite hybrid corporate governance, to be honest, when we're talking about state-owned enterprises. And definitely that is something they will think about, even though it's not on paperwork at the moment, but it will come back to them.
And then on the question about British Africanists, if I understand, so there's great folks across the board. So Frank Chiamura. But just for the audience, Frank Chiamura at the Open University, who was, we also tried to get him here, but he couldn't get the schedule, or we couldn't make the schedule work. But he does a lot of great work on China and Africa. And did you have
Write some book, yeah?
Yeah, so I can put together a list, but yeah, Sarah Brierley, George Ofosu at LSE, Fred Ajuang at King's, there's plenty of folks at the Bartlett here, as well as plenty of people at SOAS across the board. Did you have something to add to, yeah?
I just wanted to ask a question.
Okay, great. Sorry, I didn't know if you wanted to add an Africanist. Okay, great. But yeah, I'm happy to chat more after, and then we can maybe put something along with the video posting. Great. No, can I do this question? So there's a question from online. Oh, and then Simon Chinney also is an Africanist here, based here at UCL, and myself, but not African, but Africanists. Okay, so Meret Ashanafi from University of Southampton asks, do you think that Africa's future is dependent on development aid like BRI,
or the Western investment initiatives? Is there room for African agency industrializing without heavy reliance on FDI? I mean, my quick response to this is that, I mean, this is one of the core questions of how much assistance or external help do African countries or the developing world need, and how much could they be left to their own devices to develop themselves? I think this is a case-by-case answer on the degree to which the capacities that exist on the ground and the, you know, the resource wealth or the kind of economic resources and capacity that they do have is going to determine the degree to which one relies on things like the BRI, et cetera. Again, recommending another book by Dembi Somoyo called Dead Aid, and the ways in which aid is maybe doing more harm than good across the African continent, and things like that. But I don't know if anyone had else. Yeah.
I think those are good points. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm really going to try and find the question in what I'm going to say. So bear with me. So you kind of touched on it now, but I think, unfortunately, is it High Commissioner from South Africa couldn't be here?
Yeah.
And it kind of like perpetuates the same kind of narrative of like Africa being quite passive in its own narrative. And I think that's really important because it kind of shows you that even when we look at the lens through which we judge China's involvement or any other agent's involvement, we only measure it by their interest. And we don't measure it by the interest of not just Africa as a continent or the countries in Africa, but also we don't distinguish between governments and the people. So when we talk about governance and we talk about, you know, the role of governance and, you know, we also have to talk about entering contracts with corrupt governments or people who don't have African people at the heart of the contracts, and then judging the performance of that contract based on the people in power and not the actual people itself. So one of the questions I have in here is, what obligation or what duty does China, or China as a proxy to other countries that want to enter Africa, what duty do they have when they enter these deals with corrupt governments to then put that on themselves? Because obviously everyone is self-interested to a degree, but we can't then say, you know, Africa asked for this and we gave them this, but you went into business with a corrupt government. Not to say all African governments are corrupt, but we have to understand that. That's fundamentally the issue. And then looking at the self-determination aspect when we do this kind of stuff. And that question about agencies there as well. To what degree is that when we are judging how much progress Africa is making, where is self-determination in that conversation? And it's interesting when we talk about the West and China now, because this current landscape, we talk a lot about business and entrepreneurship, and then back in the day it was imperialism, right, and all that kind of stuff. But we're talking about the same kind of thing, which is neocolonialism. Whether it's about intent, whether it's about outcome, that's up for, you know, that's people's taste. But the idea is that there is an element there where you don't control your own destiny, right? And in this era we're in, it's going to be business that determines whether it is neocolonialism. We can't talk about it in any other way. So there's no point, even when we talk about sustainability and green development, when we talk about specific countries, which would make a difference here, we talk about South Africa. South Africa is a great country that we like to talk about, but sometimes it is quite an anomaly in Africa. And many will talk about South Africa as it's not really, when we look at the flows of Africa and activity that happens, it's not a good representation. But if you want to talk about maybe more about the morality, and we pick countries like Congo, for example, and we talk about cobalt, that will be maybe a different conversation we're having. So I just wanted to bring that up because sometimes we talk about business, and business is profit-seeking, whether we talk about social impact or not. Of course, the framework we're going to judge it by cannot be good or bad. So that's why it's easy to evade the question, because that's not what they operate in. So if they do something good, we have to clap, because it's like, oh, you did something above your main focus. Great. Hence, but if we talk about international development or international relations, they will talk about the balance of power. And they will talk about, actually, it's the state's instinctive desire to make sure that they're able to grow sustainably, but also looking at what's happening around the world to make sure that they're protected. So within that, sorry, guys, I said I'd find the question inside it. I did have a 0.1 question there. I think ultimately, I wanted to just say, when we talk about the West, how much of our obsession with critiquing the West about their complaints about China, which I do agree with, I do agree that actually at the end of the day, most of what the West is saying about China is because they want to validate their hypocrisies, right? Oh, China's doing this. You don't care about African people. You just want to be able to get closer to the resource. However, are we going to be blinded by that obsession that we don't actually hold China or other states or places like Russia as well to account? Because you want to penalize America so bad that we welcome China and Russia, in and don't judge them by certain metrics of the past. So I don't know if that's a...
I guess I'll try and keep this brief. I know it's a little bit maybe too early to tell, but I was just wondering to what extent sort of COVID and the sort of transfer out of COVID for China or out of zero COVID has kind of affected the trajectory of Chinese aid and especially Chinese aid in Africa.
Thanks, everyone. I'll be very brief, and I'll just piggyback off of what this lady was saying over here. And that was because you spoke a lot about entrepreneurship at the beginning, or at when and the question started. And all I could keep thinking of is, like, entrepreneurship for who? Is this Chinese entrepreneurship we're talking about? Mm-hmm. Because even though you brought up this, that, and I agree that if we're creating sort of digital spaces that potentially very... young, talented people in different African countries can use that space to build and become entrepreneurs, that's fantastic, but it almost seems like an absolute byproduct to what's actually happening in terms of investment. So I wonder if you have any comment on that, or if you have examples, for example, of where you had the TikTok example, which I didn't quite understand, but I guess, just because I don't understand that world, is that, but more of an example of how young African entrepreneurs have benefited from Chinese investment. Thank you.
Great. The first question, do you want, I want me to go? Do you, Sam, do you want to take it?
You can go, or I can try to touch on some of it. It's up to you. Yeah.
So I think this is all super important, and thank you for your contribution and the various questions that are at the heart of this. I don't know why I volunteered to even say anything.
Thanks.
But this is the right. So any foreign intervention comes with foreign interests, right? And there's no reason to lie to ourselves that the US, the World Bank, China, whoever, is not acting in their own interest. Even when it's this, you know, interest-free or loans or it's just grants that don't need to be paid back, it still has some sort of personal benefit for the country that's giving, right? I think that's the first place to start. And because of that, there is, and honestly, I mean, I don't know how to back this out or how to quantify this, but thinking about the degree to which any of these aid processes, whether it's aid or FDI or whatever it might be, is even interested in promoting development is a whole other question. Or the livelihoods of the people in these countries is completely up for debate. And I don't, like, my intuition is, like, at least what I understand about kind of Chinese approach to these things is it's much more, at least on the surface and to some degree, a partnership where there's consultation with the ruling government or with the powers that be in the recipient country of what do you want, what do you need, and how can we, and it's very above board, how can we make this work for both of us, right? Mutual benefit. But if the government is corrupt, this is prone to capture and is maybe more so prone to capture than the US or World Bank approach of, like, here's what we're going to do and here's how we're going to monitor it, right? So it's really tough, but I'm just, like, lay my cards on the table. I'm completely skeptical of the whole aid regime and international influence in these contexts, and I think a lot more could be done in thinking more about how to self-determine and homegrown development that is initiated by the state for the state, or by the people for the state. But then there's this differentiation that you rightfully mentioned, that oftentimes governments aren't interested, or at least not interested as much as they should be, in the welfare of their most vulnerable citizens.
Yeah, I'll hold the baton. So I think you really raise a very important question, not just for Chinese corporations, but for all operations across the world. What kinds of corporate social responsibilities they should take? So we have been having this kind of debate in international business and management, talking about, you know, what is the duty, right? So we talk about lots of multinational firms, especially when we're talking about those global 500 Western multinational firms. Do they really hold their moral standard high? No, it's really case by case, depending on which country, which region, which types of government to deal with. So you could see that normally we say you can have this kind of universal accepted principle and thinking about, you know, we need to keep that standard high, but in reality, it's just too good to be true. They have to deal with different types of things. Then it's back to the core about the decision to make to invest in the foreign market. We're always talking about uncertainties and risks. Corruption and all these kinds of related governance issues, they are part of the uncertainties and risks that each firm need to take into account before they enter the market. Okay? Then they have a different standard, they have different metrics to work it out. Then the question is, once they enter, or even during the contract, you know, this kind of negotiation period, some may just pull it out because they couldn't bear any further loss, any backfires whatsoever. So then the question is that when they literally operate in that market, what kinds of standard, what kinds of social responsibilities they should work. I totally agree with you about who we're talking about the interest, right? Because the narrative now we're talking more about, you know, what we think rather than the people, how they think. So that's why I think the idea about social enterprises and social entrepreneurship are going to come into this picture, because those are actually derived from the continent, derived from the local community. These are the people who actually know how they deal with the government, the different stakeholders, and how they try to find their way out to be partners of either large multinational firms, either from China or from the States or from France, so on and so forth. Because I think it's not just one firm going to actually hold a flag up and say, I'm so socially responsible, it's not going to work. It needs to actually work with the different angles and interwove the network, to be honest. But I do agree what China needs to, especially when Chinese firms criticize a lot with, you know, this kind of human rights, certain kinds of labor conditions. I think they have learned hard lessons, especially during their early involvement in Africa. So if we look at the case of the automobile industry, FAW, so they actually talk a lot about the reason why we entered the African market, because we want to produce cars for the African households and African market. Then one of the metrics, if we say so, because to be honest, we do not really have the quantified measurement about how responsible those kind of firms operate in overseas market. But we think about how localized they are, right? Whether they really create lots of job opportunities for the local market. Because this is what the government wants, what is the local people want, and also this should be in the interest of the foreign invested firms in that country. So in FAW's case is that they have 98% local employees. So this might be a very good starting point to make sure we're not just here to exploit, but we're here for the market. I think this is a very good message. And then trying to localize itself, try to align, no matter what the strategic motivations of the company to be there, but try to work with the locals. Because at the end of the day, when we're talking about FDI, right, whether we should heavily reliant on FDI, I think this is not really the question we ask. We're asking about how you can really make good use of FDI and then make sure that you internalize those kinds of productivity spillovers, whether you can really learn from the experience. Because when we look at FDI in China, it's totally different landscape compared with 1980s, 1990s. They were always placed at the superior places, but now they actually were squeezed out of the Chinese market. They're finding very hard and challenging to compete with those kind of indigenous Chinese local firms. So this is the question that we need to think about. You know, yes, all the firms, I think they all need to actually have their responsibility. And it's more important that we also need to change our perspective and to think what exactly beneficial for the local markets. So this is one of the research areas we really want to look into, and especially out of the communities, out of those kinds of local areas and local regions. And back to your question, yes, what I mentioned about, they are not actually byproduct of Chinese investment. So all entrepreneurial firms or activities, they can actually only reside in their domestic environment. They can be influenced because the internet, because of the information exchange. But we are more interested in thinking about promote and facilitate those kinds of social enterprises that starting from, rather than actually is the byproduct or certain kinds of outcome of the Chinese investment.
But China's not investing in those things. They're just that they're providing something that will help them?
Yeah, so that's the question we're talking about, the entrepreneurial ecosystem, which is going to be bringing the network, bringing the money, bringing, you know, different expertise. So this is no difference from the Chinese venture capitalist or the American ones or any other countries, because the venture capitalists, they will see the opportunity the business is going to grow. They are able to actually make profit, just like what SoftBank invested in Alibaba in the early days. I don't think that they really know it's going to boost, but you know, you take the risk as investment. But the good thing is that if you do have the business idea, the most challenge facing for those kinds of entrepreneurs, because they do not have the resources, they're always resource restricted. And then they need to have the expertise, they need to have the experience, they need to have the market knowledge, which they may not be able to get access to. And this is perfectly in African markets, no matter whether it's South Africa, Ethiopia, or the other countries, is that you need to be connected to the information you're not be able to. Bringing the outside investors actually provide those kinds of a gateway to the information, to the resources that you may need, now or later. So Chinese investors, they do actually, you know, come together to prompt the money and then try to think about whether their model, which was successful in China to some extent, can be replicated. That's what we see Uber Eats here, and that we see Uber Eats everywhere across the world. And in Africa, it's the same story.
So maybe last words?
Yeah, I know we're at time, so maybe I'll try to wrap up and touch and just also touch on the post-COVID, because I think that's interesting. So listen, great points, all great points. And I think, you know, to come back to something I said earlier about, you know, these issues of governance. So, you know, I think you're absolutely right that the fact that the world is gray doesn't mean we should, you know, slide into a world of moral relativism, right? Where, well, the U.S. is bad and China is bad and we're all killers here, right? And you know, it's both time-specific and context-specific. And I think that, you know, in the context of post-COVID as well, you know, a lot of it comes back, and I share Adam's general skepticism about foreign aid, generally, right, but, you know, comes back to how do we conceptualize development, right? You know, is it just about increasing GDP per capita of a country, right? Do issues of intra-country inequality matter? Do issues of personal freedom and, you know, macho sen and all this, you know, does that matter as well? And I think this is one issue where, you know, certainly, you know, the PRC isn't concerned about any particular mode of governance, which may be good or bad, but they certainly aren't concerned about promoting democracy and personal freedom and political expression. And, you know, alongside a lot of investment, you know, is actively exporting some of its models of surveillance technology, right, to regimes that might use that in ways that limit personal freedom. So if you care about that kind of stuff, right, I don't think that you know, all these actors are created equal. And I think this is, we're only going to see more of this in the post-COVID period, right, because COVID was really challenging for the PRC, the current PRC regime, right? And, you know, the response there probably wasn't great for them, right? You know, going zero COVID. I mean, street protests, even though they were small, even though they were isolated in the PRC, was a major thing, right? You know, which is only going to, I think, with this regime, lead to an increasing tightening, which they will then want to promote, not necessarily promote, but, you know, we'll be happy to share with other parts of the world to, you know, make sort of mass surveillance and control an acceptable international norm. And I think that we'll see more of that alongside their engagement in Africa and other places, right? And, you know, sort of the ongoing global battle right now on Huawei, right, you know, is, you know, if it's a battle, you know, the West certainly seems to be aligning, or I hate the term the West, right, but, you know, Northern Europe, you know, Western Europe, North America, Japan. But, you know, the global South, another term I also hate, right, you know, is seems to be, by and large, right, much more comfortable with these technologies. And I think that's going to be a really important thing over the next 10 years.
Excellent. Great. So let me one thing about post-COVID is that at least public opinion toward China in Africa that I'm aware of, it did take a dip because of COVID. Oh,
did take a dip because of COVID and the association of its origins in China. But also there's, and the kind of linking back to your point about where did the people fit into this, and thinking about the ways in which public opinion of domestic populations receiving Chinese investment aid, etc., might constrain or influence government choices, right, and their choice to pursue, continue to pursue relationships with China. There's some great work by Macaulay, Wong, and Pearson on that. And then myself and colleagues also have some work in Malawi about how people respond to different types of projects and the debt that it brings about and the environmental degradation that might come with it. And how people, the average citizen, at least in our data in Malawi, is people are very cued into what this is doing to their localities and their sovereignty and their sense of self-determination. And these are important things to also consider that I think is only beginning to be investigated in this context. So, okay. With that, thank you, everyone. Thanks for your participation, and we appreciate this fantastic discussion. I learned a lot, and I hope everyone did.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.